Well, we're still in Luke chapter 9. We began consideration of Luke chapter 9, verses 10 through 17 a couple of weeks ago. And we all are very, very familiar with the basic issues of the story, the feeding of the 5,000, which is often altered into the feeding of the 10 or 15, or even 20,000, depending on how evangelistically speaking you want to be. But I would like for us this morning to consider that story again in the light of its setting. Since Luke 9 actually begins with a serious test of faith, I mean, verses 1 through 6, Jesus takes the men that he has appointed to be his apostles, the 12, and he tells them that he wants them to go through the villages and cities and proclaim the gospel and preach the kingdom of God. And he absolutely prohibits them from making any kind of provisions for their own neediness in the process. They can't take anything with them. No food, no money, nothing that they think they might need in the weeks to come as they're going from village to village. That was an enormous test of faith if they were going to obey him. And that's how Luke starts. He opens this chapter, having concluded the whole issue of chapter 8, with this test of the 12. At the end of Luke 9, the chapter ends with people making excuses for why they won't go and proclaim the gospel or preach the kingdom. They have one thing to do and then another. They all say they'll do it, but, you know, first I got to do this or first I got to do that. And Jesus just plainly says, no, you either do what I tell you or forget it. He doesn't say it in exactly those words, but that's what he means. At the end of the chapter, he says, if you put your hand to the plow and turn back, you're not worthy of the kingdom. So we know that chapter 9 is in this context of the issue of following him and trusting him in the process. And it's my assumption on that basis that the point of the chapter is that those who are going to be involved in legitimate ministry are going to have to pass certain tests before they can fulfill Jesus' expectations of them. He's going to test them along the way. This record of the feeding of the 5,000 in verses 10 through 17 is an example of that kind of a test. In our study last week, we saw that the disciples didn't handle the test very well in the beginning. Instead of relying upon Jesus' wisdom and power, they took it upon themselves to try to tell him how to handle the issues that had developed as he was teaching the people the kingdom truths and healing them as they had need. The 12 came to him to tell him what to do next. It's just ludicrous, but it's so normal that we don't even see it as being ludicrous. But that's the reason for the necessity of these tests. There's got to be something to jolt human beings out of their propensity to trust in themselves and their own wisdom and their own resources, and to cast themselves absolutely, completely upon the character and instructions of the one who does know and has the power. But to get people to move from the self-trust to the trust in Jesus, where their own well-being is absolutely at stake, that's a no small problem, and that's why Jesus is doing what he's doing. As long as human beings think that they know more about how to live than the God of life knows about how to live, they will never live. They will just think they are while they go about their dying. Life at its most basic identity, is participating with God in His character and His agenda. And this participation has a very exclusive root. You got to trust Him. Faith is the bottom line. And that means that in order for us to learn from this text, we have to understand what it means to believe Him. Our need for the understanding is at least partially met by this record of Jesus and the feeding of the 5,000. So we will, I think, do very well to consider the facts as Luke presents them to us. And there are several. Now, we've worked our way all the way down to verse 13. The 12 thought that they could handle the circumstances as they were developing, and Jesus threw them a curve that was out of sight. Verse 13 says, He said to them, You feed them. You give them something to eat. And they said, We have no more than 5 loaves and 2 fish. And John tells us those didn't even belong to them. They belonged to a young fellow that had brought his own lunch with him. And then their other excuse was, Well, maybe we should go and just buy food for all these people. Now, think about that. Just how much of a bank account do you think they had? And then he says in verse 14, For there were about 5,000 men. This is the focus on the male, the 20-year-old and up, who could serve as a military personnel. The men were numbered about 5,000. So we have no clue as to how many people were there. We just know there were 5,000 adult men. So I want us to start by considering some of these facts that I think will help us to understand what Jesus expects in terms of our believing. The first thing that I want to be as clear as I can be on is that the circumstances had incrementally developed without the disciples being involved at all in how they were developing to create a problem. I mean, it tells us that Jesus was followed by the multitudes and that he began in verse 11 to speak to them about the kingdom of God, and he was healing those that had need of healing. And then the day started to bow its head, and the disciples recognized it's getting on to be supper time, and we didn't have any lunch, and neither did this crowd. So they as a group, verse 12, the 12 came to Jesus and started telling him how to run the business. The thing that I want us to understand is the disciples didn't intentionally set out that day to be confronted with the problem of a hungry group of people. They just were going wherever Jesus went, and the multitude followed, and Jesus started doing what he'd been doing, and then all of a sudden there was this problem. And that way life runs? We don't expect it. It just comes that way. We're just doing what needs to be done, and all of a sudden there's some problem. Well, the 12 responded to the problem in what I'll just call a very pragmatic way. It had all of the overtones of normalcy. Their solution was very pragmatic. Jesus, there are so many people here, and we're out in this deserted place, and they're getting hungry, and so you need to send them off where they can find lodging for the night and food to eat. Very pragmatic. Makes lots of sense. But the fact that the 12 came and told him that tells us that they were acting out of all of the characteristic self-sufficient bossiness that just is normal to human beings. Self-sufficient bossiness. We'll tell you how to do stuff because we know how. And we're telling you. That's the self-sufficient bossiness stuff. And that's the problem with trust. There is no trust there. This attitude that is just so normal and so pragmatic and so reasonable just reveals how badly they needed to be transformed by the renewing of their mind. They desperately needed to have that attitude just absolutely trashed in their brain so that it didn't come back up. Of course, it's easy to say that. Another thing to do it. And in the record, after they came to him to tell him how to run the business, he said in verse 13, No, you feed them. You give them something to eat. He was unwilling on this occasion to let their self-sufficient bossiness go. This time. I mean, there's no telling how many times he'd let it go in the past. and how many times he was going to let it go in the future. Because when it's such a knee-jerk human thing, you have to tolerate a lot. And Jesus did. You want an example of tolerance, you just think about Jesus and Judas Iscariot. He knew how to be tolerant of stuff, and yet, in this record that Luke gives us, this time he says, no, we're not going to tolerate that. We're going to confront it. So he gave them a command to feed the multitude themselves. And even for Jesus, this is pretty much over the top. I mean, stop and think about it. Put yourself in the shoes of the 12. And you haven't done anything deliberately to provoke Jesus. You're just doing the way things you always do them. And you came to him and you said, look, this group needs to eat and you need to do something about it. So do it. And he says, no, you do it. You feed them. You don't send them away. You feed them. And they're standing there looking dumbstruck. You got to be kidding. And the reason they would feel that way is because he had to be, didn't he? I mean, this is so outlandish. The 12 are going to feed 5,000 adult men and whoever else. Now, you know, up to this point, Jesus had done some mighty miracles. He'd raised a couple people from the dead. He'd cleansed the leper. He'd done all kinds of stuff that Luke has told us about. And he had done so many of those things and healed so many people of so many problems that the disciples had kind of locked, you know, they'd kind of fallen into this, well, yeah, this is Jesus. This is the norm. This is what he does. And fine for him to do that. But in this case, he's not volunteering to do this. He's telling them to. And what that means is that he was serious in verses 1 to 6. He was sending them out to do as he had done. So he was going to require them to do some stuff that was over the top. It was so much over it that even Herod heard about it. But it's really easy when it's Jesus doing it. But what happens when he then turns the table and says, okay, I've done this. You've seen me do it. Now you do it. And they say, there ain't no way, Jesus. The command was totally unexpected. It was completely impossible because they were thinking out of a pragmatic, self-sufficient, I can handle life attitude. And they couldn't be more wrong. But who doesn't think that way? I mean, when we read what they said for him to do, there's absolutely no problem with this. In fact, there's no telling how many times they've done this in the past. Jesus was followed by multitudes of people all the time. And there are only two records in the whole scenario of Jesus' life where he took upon himself to provide them with free lunch. Twice in maybe 7 years of ministry. The rest of the time, what'd they do at the end of the day? And that's probably why they lapsed into this double problem of, well, you know, that's Jesus, that's not my problem. And then turn right around and be bossy about what he needs to do. Come tell him what to do. But the thing we have to keep in mind is the first fact is this. He uttered to them a command. Do this. In a very real sense, verses 1 to 6 of this chapter is the same kind of thing. He said, okay, I've been preaching the kingdom. I've been announcing the good news. I've been healing. I've been casting out demons. I want you to do it now. And by the way, when you go to do it, don't take anything with you. But you know, in the final analysis, that was a challenge, but all they had to do to fulfill it was open their mouth, repeat what they'd heard Jesus say. I mean, they'd had to heard gazillion sermons by this point. Just open your mouth, say what he said, go from village to village and do that. The only really hard thing about it was, what am I going to eat? Where am I going to stay? What am I going to wear if I tear my garment? Or, you know. But those are... But when we come to verse 13, whoo, all of a sudden, it is so far beyond their ability. I mean, there is no way they're going to be able to open their mouth and do this. But he told them to do it, commanded them to do it. That's the first thing the text tells us. The second thing is that the disciples apparently had gained no insight from their first test. This is an extremely dangerous fact, but it's really not all that unusual. If we go to Mark chapter 8, Mark 8 is the record of the feeding of the 5,000 in Mark's record. And it says in verse 13 and 14, Jesus had fed the 5,000, he had sent the multitudes away and put his disciples or sent them in a boat to leave. And it says in verse 13 that he left, he embarked and went away to the other side, and they had forgotten to take bread, and they didn't have more than one loaf in the boat with them. And he was giving them orders, saying, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began to discuss with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus said, why do you discuss the fact that you have no bread? Do you not see yet or understand? Do you have a hardened heart, having eyes? Do you not see and having ears? Do you not hear and do you not remember when I broke the five loaves for the 5,000? How many baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? 12? Oh, by the way, I've got this issue in chapter 8. It's not feeding the 5,000, it's feeding the 4. The 5 was back in chapter 6. I'll refer to that in a minute. When I broke the 7 for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of broken pieces did you pick up? And they said 7. And he said, don't you understand? When I was teaching my seniors in senior English, I came to this place, and so I just asked them, do you understand yet? Of course, they hadn't seen these kind of things, so it was a little unfair. But apparently, in verse 14, they had forgotten to take more bread, or take bread, and then they began to discuss the fact in verse 16 that they didn't have anything to eat. And Jesus wants to know, where did that come from? Well, it's not hard for us because we participate with them in their dullness, but where did that come from? I mean, if there were 12 baskets left over and 7 baskets left over, is the fact that they don't have any bread on this trip going to be a problem? Well, maybe. They haven't learned anything yet. Look back at chapter 6 where the record is of the feeding of 5,000. And after the feeding of the 5,000, John tells us that the group was going to come and make him king by force. So they're going to put this guy that can feed them on the throne. And it says in verse 45 that he immediately made his disciples get in the boat and go ahead of him to the other side. In other words, he wanted his disciples out of that mindset. We're going to take him, make him a king by force. And then he bid them farewell, went up on the mountain to pray, and then at 3 o'clock in the morning, he saw them straining at the oars out there in the lake or the Sea of Galilee, and they weren't making any progress. And so he went walking to them on the water. And they were terrified, verse 49. And it says in verse 51, he got into the boat with them, and the wind stopped, and they were greatly astonished because they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves. Their hearts were hardened. Now, the point that I'm trying to make here is that Luke chapter 9, verses 1 to 6 was supposed to be test of faith that would prepare them for the next one. But in order to be prepared for the next one, you've got to learn this one. And in your learning, you've got to see the implications for life so that when the next one comes, you have something to build off of. But apparently they didn't. And like I said, that's not unusual. Human beings are made this way. That's the way we are. That's why we have to go through the same kinds of stuff over and over, because we just don't learn that well. So in Luke's record, when Jesus says, "You feed them," they started making objections that were supposed to prove that Jesus' command was ludicrous. That's what the objections were supposed to prove. "Jesus, you're being ridiculous here. It's just ridiculous. How many times have you sent the people away to go get food and lodging for the night, and all we've done is tell you that needs to be done now too, and you tell us to feed them? We've got 5 loaves, 2 fish, and that won't even do more than fill up the kid that brought it." They don't say that in this text, but I mean, they couldn't have been our 1.5 loaves. And even if they were, what difference would it have made to 5,000 people? But they weren't. They were just little loaves, a couple of fish, probably a fairly good meal for one half-grown boy. So that proves that Jesus' command is ludicrous. And then they do that little other jab. "Well, maybe we could go buy food for all of them." I think that they knew that Jesus knew how much money was in the till. And I think that they knew that Jesus knew how terribly difficult it would be for the 12 of them to go to all of the various villages and towns and round up enough food for 5,000 men, regardless of whether they had the money or not. You see, what they're doing is simply trying to retain themselves in their own self-sufficient, bossy attitude. They're just making Jesus to be the one who's out of line here. So that this response of theirs to the command with objections is nothing more than a retrenchment of the initial failure within these circumstances, which was self-sufficient bossiness expressed. "I know how to live. You apparently have forgotten. Let me tell you how it works." That's just the attitude. The disciples are simply doing what everybody tends to do, and that is they assume they're smarter than God, and so they'll go to whatever length to validate the assumption when he puts them on the spot. And if you think I'm being too hard on them, remember Job? How was the last time you read the book of Job? It's this long. Starts out with Satan creating a major difficulty for Job. It ends with Job finally getting his head screwed on right and recognizing that he has been guilty of assuming himself to be more intelligent and more fair than God. And what's all the stuff in between? All those chapters and chapters and chapters of stuff. Well, what it is it's a demonstration of men arguing about how it should be, how things should be. Should be this way, should be that way. Got to be this way because that's the way. And all that is human beings pooling their ignorance and saying, "We know how to live better than God does." And Job fell into that because of his pain until God gave him a sense of who he was. And then all of a sudden Job says, "I can't believe I was so dumb to say all those things." See, the disciples are not any different than anybody, than Job, everybody. We attempt to handle our problems with pragmatic solutions apart from the gift of divine wisdom, and it's always a recipe for failure. Even if God very graciously and patiently tolerates it, it still isn't going to work. It's a recipe for failure. And the objections of the disciples are rooted in very pragmatic considerations. 5 loaves, 2 fish, 5,000 adult men is not going to match. And the cost of buying food for those. So, Second fact is this. That issue was a most fundamental thing, and that is the tests were a challenge to faith. And what works always works, and what doesn't work never works. Verses 1 to 6 was a test of faith. They passed it. Why? Because they believed him. They decided to put themselves at risk and go do it and not make provisions. And they discovered in the process of the outworking of their dependence that he met them every time with the provision that they would have made for themselves if he hadn't told them not to. And so he just met them day after day. And in a little while, they actually didn't worry about it anymore, because it was too normal for him to just meet their need. But as soon as that little cycle of tests is gone, another one comes along and they don't even remember that. They get a command from Jesus to do something that's just absolutely impossible, and they start making excuses. What would have happened if they'd have just believed him? Well, the same thing that happened anyway. What I mean by that is, Jesus didn't accept their unbelief. He, as soon as they acknowledged that they couldn't do what he told them to do, I mean, this is where their self-sufficient bossiness hit the turf. If you really mean that, Jesus, we just simply cannot. And then he said, okay, now that you understand, do this. And he gave them instructions, and he broke the bread and the fish and handed it out, and they fed them. They did exactly what he told them to do. Which would have happened if they'd have trusted him, except that there would have been a major difference in them. So that's the second thing that we need to be aware of. He commanded them. And whether they were going to believe him or not had already been shown as a valid thing. They could believe him or not, but if they did, they'd discover that he would do exactly as he instructed or planned. And that brings us to the third fact. At issue in every test is whether the tested have come to grips with what God really requires. You see, the real issue in being tested is whether you learn what it was you were supposed to learn. And the issue for the test is, okay, what am I supposed to learn here? And the answer is to trust me, that when I tell you to do something, you can do it, if you will trust me. That was what they were supposed to learn. They weren't supposed to learn that they could do this if they were godly enough, or educated enough, or whatever enough. They could do it if they would just trust him. That was what they were supposed to have learned. If trust works once, it'll always work. That's the point. Now, that means then that we need to be as clear as we can possibly be about what this believing means. And I'm going to use the text as an illustration of what it means to believe. And I'm going to start by process of eliminations. A lot of times we can understand if we just get rid of the junk first. In our record, the disciples, who were very typical human beings, self-sufficient, bossy, it was not the exercise of the typical self-sufficient bossiness where the faith is fixated on one's own superior wisdom. That's not faith. You can just get rid of that initially. Faith is never being content with what you think you know, and then operating in the absence of God's wisdom simply because you know better. You know how to handle this, so handle it. That's not faith. Faith is never going to find a sufficient root in any kind of self-sufficient attitude. Never. I don't care how many times we go around the deal, how many things we think we've learned. If the thinking that we've learned it creates a sense of self-sufficiency, it's not learned. So we can get rid of that. It's not faith. Depending on ourselves, it's not faith. That should go without saying. Secondly, faith is not a deliberate manipulation of circumstances so that God gets put on the spot, so that faith is then being vindicated because we put God on the spot and He came through. Trey and Robin were attending a church up in somewhere up there on the other side of Hickory when we first moved here, and he told me, and some of you guys too, that he had attended a business meeting of the church in which they were going to discuss whether they were going to build this $1 million plant. And so Trey, just newest member, you know, where's the money going to come from? Oh, we're trusting God for that. And the implication was, sit down and shut up and start trusting. The problem with that was, it's contrary to Scripture. And claiming that you're trusting when your principles are messed up is not trust. Whenever we violate the Word of God, and then God is now on the spot because of things that we've done, and we're gonna trust Him so that He proves that He's faithful to our trust, when our trust is absolutely wrong. The leaders of that church have the same Bible I have, and they know that Paul wrote in it, owe no man anything but to love. And yet they had a vision of a great plant. They didn't have the money to build it, but owe no man anything didn't mean you couldn't borrow the money. I mean, if you're a church and you're guided by the spiritual leadership and you've bathed the thing in prayer, you can violate that principle if you want to. And then if anybody challenges you, just tell them, start believing. That does not work. Anytime we put God on the spot by violating something and then telling everybody we're trusting Him to come through for us, that's not faith. That's just manipulation. Does God not provide in those situations? A lot of times He does, because He's very gracious. But it's a totally wrong concept of faith. It's not an issue of our creating the agenda and then expecting Him to validate our confidence. So you can get rid of that. These disciples fell into this thing without any expectation. They didn't create it. It's just there. And then thirdly, faith is not a vacuous word that has no specific content. Just trust. Trust for what? Just trust. You know, you gotta believe. Believe what? Well, you just gotta believe. As if some kind of vacuous believing will make a difference. That's not faith either. Those things are obviously, you can throw those out. When Jesus said, you feed them, He was illustrating a very real concept of belief, faith. And so let's switch over to the things we can learn by observation. In the first place, verse 13 is a command that addresses a circumstance that they didn't plan on. They didn't create it. It wasn't their mess they made. It was just there. Faith is a response to the circumstances as they develop. That's the first thing about faith. It's just a response to the circumstances that your God has allowed in your life to come to this point. It's just going to be your response to those circumstances. Second thing that we see is that if we're going to sidestep the disciples' failure, we're going to have a faith that is a response that begins with an assumption. And that assumption is, I don't know what to do here. Now, sometimes that sounds like an excuse, because, well, why don't you know? Haven't you been here before? Yeah, but every time I've been here before, I just handled it. And some of the things I did blew up in my face so big that afterwards I realized I didn't handle that right. And so, at this point, I don't know what to do here. Jesus says, you feed them. The disciples say, I don't know how to do that. That would have been a response of faith. Because that would have been an admission. You know, I just don't know what to do here. It begins with that. Faith always starts there. Because as soon as I think I know, I don't know. Paul said, beware if you think you stand. So the first reality is faith is a response to the circumstances that come. You don't control those. You just respond to them. Secondly, it's a response that starts with, well, God, here we are in this circumstance. What do we do? Thirdly, faith is always a response that has a most fundamental other assumption. Instead of simply assuming, I know what to do here, let's do this, the assumption is that God and I have been united because He's responded to my need with His provision and I've trusted Him. And so now we're united. And that unity means this. In the context of my circumstance, my ignorance, I turn to the one who says, trust me, I'm the supplier of the ability for you to handle this. Trust me and you will discover that you can do what I tell you. Just trust me. And then secondly, this unity assumes that I can only do that when I'm pursuing His agenda. We have such a mixed bag of things in terms of agenda stuff that we just automatically assume that God's in favor of our agenda. You know, that's why we have these signs. God is my co-pilot. I had a guy who made a reputation for himself going from Bible study group to Bible study group trying to tell people how to trust God, and he said this, if we can just get God on our side, and then he went on with his baloney. He should have said, if we can just get on God's side. But see, it's just so, we've got it figured out. God just needs to agree with us that we've got it figured out. And then everything will work. No. Faith assumes that the unity that God has established with me because He's met my need and I've trusted Him and He's united Himself to me because He's united me to Himself by the baptism of the Spirit of God. I can depend on Him to supply, but I can only depend on Him to supply for His agenda, not mine. So that's another thing that the text tells us, that the disciples were commanded by Jesus to feed this massive crowd. That was a statement of Jesus' agenda. Do it. Fourthly, faith is a response to a specific divine declaration of what it is He wants within the context of the developing circumstances. When Jesus said, you feed them, that's a paraphrase, you give them something to eat, He expressed His agenda. He expressed what He wanted in this set of circumstances from these 12, and faith would have said, oh, man, this is going to be neat. We're going to feed this crowd of people. It's going to be a miracle beyond understanding. This is going to be fantastic. Okay, Jesus, you just supply and we'll do it. That would have been faith. Obviously, we don't read those words here. You see, when I say that it's specific divine declaration, I want you to be really clear on this. It is highly unlikely that you or I or anybody in this room will ever hear God tell us to feed 5,000 men on the spur of the moment. That's just probably never going to happen in your experience. I say probably because I don't know God well enough to say it won't. But it's probably not going to. You see, this was a spur of the moment response to a circumstance where He clearly told them what He wanted and it was their responsibility to trust Him. The second problematical thing in applying this is that Jesus said those words flat out loud and in probably Aramaic that they could understand. You feed them. We don't get that kind of stuff from Jesus. He's not walking here anymore. He's invisible. He's ascended to the third heaven. The Spirit that He sent dwells within us in an invisible way. So the vast majority of what we hear God tell us to do will be directly out of His Word. So when we run into our circumstances, if the word doesn't address them, then we can be excused for saying, I don't know what to do here. But if the word tells us what to do in this kind of a situation, then faith says, this is what God wants, this is what we're going to do. That's what faith does. It responds to specific revelation. And then I want to make this observation, kind of a long one, but it may be the most important one. Faith is a response that's seriously dependent upon a continuum of legitimate responses. And what I mean by that is this. We have fallen victim in our generation to a couple of major heresies in regard to the issue of faith. One of those heresies is the breakdown of the distinction that exists between what I'm going to call relational reality and accomplishment reality. God operates on both levels. There is this issue of the relational reality that He's willing to have with us, that He invites us to have with Him. And then there is this accomplishment reality where He invites us to labor together with Him to accomplish a certain thing. It has only to do with the relational in the sense that because we're relating to Him, He will let us work with Him. But those have to be distinct in our minds or it's heresy. People often expect accomplishment to flow as naturally as forgiveness flows. Let me see if I can clarify. There are no actions that cannot be forgiven. At any point that you're willing to trust God for forgiveness of any kind of sin that you've ever done, just got through doing whatever, at the point of faith, you're forgiven. Done. God will never bring that back up again. But there are a lot of accomplishment things that are never going to be accomplished because they require a step of faith all along the way. And it's kind of like building a wall of brick where you have to put each brick in its place or you don't end up with the wall. That doesn't have anything to do directly with the relational faith because if you start building this wall and then you get sidetracked into some sin because you lost the relational connection somehow, and then you go over here and you piddle around in your sin for a while, and the wall, it had to be done a certain amount of time, certain size and all that, but you wasted too much time over here. You can come to God at any point and say, would you forgive me? And He will do it like that. But that wall will not be built because the accomplishment required a continuum of faith. I read on the web this week that a certain pastor up in, I think it was Virginia or West Virginia, I don't remember which state, had been beaten to death by his daughter's boyfriend. The boyfriend not only beat the daddy to death, he beat the mama to death, he beat the girlfriend to death, and he beat her friend to death. Now, how did that all happen? Well, the devil's in the details. The guy and his wife had been separated for over a year, and he was the pastor of the church. He wasn't real happy with his daughter going to these horrorcore concerts, listening to all this garbage music, because he didn't like the lyrics and all that stuff. But he himself took her to some of those because he said he wanted to protect her. Well, the boyfriend had heard all that junk and had bought into it, and he got very violent. So whenever it came out that Daddy didn't like what he was doing with his daughter, he just beat him to death. My question is, how did that guy get in that situation? One step at a time, violating one biblical principle after another. Now, granted, he could have been beaten to death for being a godly man, but he wasn't. But he was the pastor. And by all accounts, he was a fantastic preacher. Just a disobedient one. What I'm trying to say here is, the relational facts are facts. You can confess a sin at any point and God will forgive you. He'll reestablish the relationship you have with Him as soon as you're willing to humble yourself and ask Him to. But boy, that project you had going, that's not going to be finished if you're not going to trust him along the way. That's a heresy that we've bought into because we make no distinction between what God's willing to do with us one-on-one in a relationship and what he's willing to do with us on a continuum. There are things that church leaders can do that disqualify themselves from ever being church leaders again. But you won't find very many churches that agree with that. They'll say, oh no, he's confessed, he's forgiven, so he ought to have his job back. Well, that's a confusion. Relational and accomplishment, reality. And then there is this heresy also that we're subject to that arises out of a pet doctrine that we hold. It's often said this way, once saved, always saved. I don't have a problem with that. It's true. But it creates a mentality that I have a real problem with. And the mentality is that by a single act of faith, life will be carried on the shoulders of that one act. So, I don't have to be careful every day to be trusting. I've believed. In one of the denominations of which I'm very familiar, they have spring and fall Bible conferences. And it is the testimony on a regular historical basis that twice a year people get right with God. And the reason? Because they bought into this idea that if you just trust Jesus one time, life will be carried for you from then on. Well, every single act of faith does bring its own reward. You cannot give somebody a drink of water as an act of faith and lose your reward for doing it. You can't. Jesus said that. Every act of faith brings its own reward with it, but so does every act of unbelief bring its consequence with it. So that I can never rest on my laurels saying, oh yeah, I believe in Jesus, and then go about my life without faith. Every day, continuum. That's what's going on here. The disciples had lapsed into this idea that since they were the 12, they could tell Jesus what to do and not have to trust. Faith requires that we not buy into the distortion of relational reality into accomplishment reality. It's not going to work. And secondly, faith requires that we not assume that because I trusted him yesterday, I can goof off today. Not going to happen. So faith is a response that's seriously dependent on this continuum of legitimate faith responses so that I can't afford to forget verses 1 to 6 when I get to verse 13. And then the accomplishment of every non-relational agenda is every bit like I illustrated with a completed brick wall, where every brick requires an act of faith and unbelief can just torpedo that accomplishment effort. It'll just wipe it out. And then also, this continuum of legitimate responses means that God does not do what we expect unless we have been expecting all along. In other words, I have to trust him yesterday, today, tomorrow, the next day. Or I'm going to be like the 12, given a job that's way beyond me, and me saying to Jesus, are you nuts? This will not work. And Jesus said, no, with that attitude, it won't. But I didn't tell you to do this in your own wisdom and out of your own resources and in separation from the unity that I've given you with my Father. You trust me and you'll see it done. So, let me bring all this together. I believe that in the record of the feeding of the 5,000 with Jesus' imperative given, that Luke is recording a statement about what disciples are supposed to do with God's words. They're supposed to look at what he says and believe that that's exactly what he desires, and then, without any evaluation of their resources or their wisdom or their ability, they're supposed to say, whoa, this is over my head. I'll be glad to do this, Lord, but you're going to have to supply or it isn't going to get done. And there it goes. It's done. That's what he's trying to say. It's a statement about what the disciples are supposed to do with the words of God, but it's also a statement about who the disciples were to really believe. And that is the bigger picture, Jesus as the bread of life. That's what John said, the feeding of 5,000 men. Jesus is the source of our life. He is the bread of life. This was just an illustration to prove that he could do it. It's kind of like, you know, John wrote his gospel a lot later than Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And he thought about the impact of some of the big ticket miracles that Jesus did, and he selected seven of them, or eight if you count the one after the resurrection in the end of the gospel. And for John, a most notable miracle took place out of the season and before its time, when he turned 180 gallons of water into wine, like that. And it was the best wine the master of the feast had ever tasted. And that 180 gallons of water suddenly becoming the best wine the guy had ever tasted was nothing more than a statement that Jesus made in John's gospel. I'm come that you might have life and that you might have it abundantly, because the joy that wine produces was supposed to be the illustration of the joy of life. And Jesus says, if you'll let me, I'll produce that kind of joy for you. That's what I can do. That's what this 180 gallons is all about. And then a little bit later, he records the feeding of the 5,000, and then he launches into this bread of life discourse where he says, I'm the bread of life. If you will eat me, you will have life. But you don't, you go on a starvation diet from me, and all you'll get is a fake facsimile. You may fake everybody else out, but you're not going to have the life if you don't eat the bread. And feeding 5,000 people with five loaves and two fish was just Jesus' way of saying, look, I mean this. When I tell you to do something, you can do it if you will trust me. And when it's all said and done, you will have put another brick in the wall that I want you to build. But if you don't trust me, you come up with all these excuses and all this stuff, then I'll forgive you when you come back and ask me to, but the wall's not going to be built. This is what's going on in this text. These disciples were being schooled by Jesus to be the ones who would build the church by their testimony. They weren't going to be able to do it if they didn't learn how to trust him. So Jesus just scheduled these little tests along the way. Maybe not so little. Maybe huge. But nonetheless, he says, okay, here's your circumstance. What are you going to do in it? I'm telling you, this is what I want you to do. What are you going to do? A little bit later, here's some more circumstances. Okay, I've told you what I want you to do here. What are you going to do? That's our lives, folks. That's what it means to be a child of God. Trained to believe. It takes a while. We all have this comfort zone of natural self-sufficiency and natural bossiness. We know better than God does. And he just kind of shrugs his shoulder and says, all right, but let me show you how different life could be if you would just trust me. Let's pray together. Father, as we consider these guys who were on the receiving end of an absolutely preposterous, impossible command, we recognize how desperately we need to learn how to trust what you say and do according to it by depending on your provision. And we freely acknowledge that we haven't done well at this on many occasions, and we ask that at the relational level you would forgive us, but also that you would plug us into whatever agenda you have for us and our circumstances, and remind us so that we don't become like the disciples who go through the cycle and then don't consider, and as a consequence, don't learn. We desperately need your Spirit to do this on our behalf, because that's the kind of life we really want to live. And so we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.